Thank you so much, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, coast to coast, border to border, around the world on the American Forces Radio Network, 925 on a Tuesday out here Pacific time. That means we check in with Karen Lyle, who co-hosts the SailSportTalk.com segment. And we have a very nice guest today. We'll get to him in a second. But first, Karen, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, I was just remembering this morning how you used to come over on BART and I used to come over on my boat, and we used to meet at the studio and instead of being staying in place.
Yeah, that seems like and a long, long time ago.
And I noticed then how much taller you are than I am.
Yes, 6'2", not freakishly tall, yes.
Yeah.
All right, well,
yeah,
we're very happy to bring in... Yes, we're very happy to bring in from the Royal Navy Vice Admiral John Henry Stuart McAnally, someone who served on Her Majesty's yacht Britannia, also some frigates as well, a very prolific and storied career in the Royal Navy. Admiral McAnally, thank you so much for coming on. When you first started as a sub-lieutenant, did you see yourself becoming an admiral someday?
No. Would anyone? I suppose I had some hopes, but I was realistic and knew that there was no guarantee of them being met.
You know, I was actually very intrigued to find out that you and Sir Robin Knox Johnson know each other. It was really quite a surprise that you both live in Portsmouth.
Well, Karen, I wonder, did Robin tell you of how we first met?
No.
Well, in addition to all his many other accomplishments as obviously one of the most famous sailors in the world and as a Royal Naval Reserve officer and a Merchant Navy officer, Robin was doing a course at a Royal Navy School of Gunnery at the same time as me in way back in, dare I say it, 1965. And I was in a group of sub-lieutenants doing this course. There were about 14 of us, and we'd brought as our communal transport a 1938 fire engine, which had served in London throughout the Blitz, the bombing of London during the Second World War. And as late as 1965 and 66, we were all riding at the open back of this big fire engine. And Robin and I, he came and took a ride with us one time. So that's when we first met. And Robin came to live in Old Portsmouth, where I've been for some time, a few years ago. And so we're close neighbors and good friends.
Where did you grow up? Because I talked to Sir Robin about the Blitz, and he was just a baby at the time. Do you have any recollection of that?
Well, I'm a bit younger than that. I was born in 1945, okay. And I don't know if your listeners can take an somewhat indelicate thing, but my mother, who was the first female officer in the London Fire Brigade, we were near London. It's like just in the outskirts of London, near a lovely park called Richmond Park in the southwest of London. And my mother was on the throne, as you might say, heavily pregnant with twins in late 1944, when the first German V-2 missile landed about a mile away with an almighty explosion, a ton of explosive. And she subsequently said, "You and your sister nearly went down the pan."
Wow, that was certainly a memorable experience for her, I'm sure.
I hope I hear a chuckle and not horror.
Well, I think because we're not going through that experience now, I hope we can have a bit of a chuckle. You know, you and I had an opportunity to talk a little bit, and we actually were introduced to each other quite independent of Sir Robin, so it was quite fun to see that connection. But you mentioned that the rescue maneuver that Robin was talking about last time was called the Williamson turn, to go back to get a vessel to turn around and come back to where it was originally. Did you ever use the Williamson turn to rescue a man over the man overboard who survived
the
13 days at sea?
I use it very frequently on man overboard practices, which is something that all ships do. And the Williamson turn, which is a term, we call it that in both the Royal Navy and the United States Navy. And you throw off some 60 degrees from your original heading and then use the same amount of wheel back in the opposite direction to the reciprocal of your course. And it should bring you back exactly down the same track. And it's used when you can't see a man overboard or don't know where he is, but do know that he's somewhere close by. I have been involved in the recovery of a man overboard, but we didn't actually know that this person was missing until some 6 hours after they'd jumped gone overboard. So the Williamson turn was not applicable. I could tell you more about it if you like.
Yes.
Oh, I would actually love to hear about the rescue, because I think that guy lived for 13 days at sea before you found him. Is that right?
About 13 hours.
13 hours. Okay. I was wondering about that.
I was actually serving in the United States Navy, and you might be interested to know how that came about, too, as well. The summer of 1967, I was the navigator of a minesweeper based in Malta. A very nice appointment. And I was a command duty officer or officer of the day sitting in the wardroom when our radio man, our single radio man, came to me and said he had a Deltext officer's signal. And what that meant, Deltext means delicate text, and officer's means it can only be decrypted using a special code card to which kept in a locked safe to which only officers have access. So I got the card, went along to the radio shack, and as he began to type the coded crypts in, I took the decoded tape off the machine, which was something like an Enigma, an American invention called a KL-7, common to NATO, and got a huge flutter in my heart when the first words in the signal were Lieutenant or Lieutenant McAnally. I realized it was about me. And it went on to say, it's being considered for 1 year's exchange service with the United States Navy. Please report whether he is a volunteer and considered suitable. So I got out the ENCODE card, prepared a reply, Lieutenant McAnally is a volunteer and is considered most suitable, and took them both to the captain. And I'm glad to say you approved the second one. So there we were in the USS Mole, actually deploying to the 6th Fleet from Newport, Rhode Island, which was our normal base, as a squadron of 5 destroyers and a tanker. And we were about 200 miles north of the Azores in February 1968. Having practiced man overboard drills in the afternoon, we sort of shut down for a quiet night passage. And just after midnight, I was woken. I was the navigator of the USS Mole. The captain had said that he'd obtained Washington's permission for a foreign officer to be the navigator, that they had asked the British authorities, can we court-martial him if he gets it wrong? To which apparently my home people replied, no, you can't, but don't worry, we surely will. Anyway, it was told that one of our seamen had failed to show up for the mid-watch, midnight to 4 o'clock, and a search of the ship couldn't find him. And on being asked, a member of the crew had said that they'd seen him walking aft wearing one of these big, heavy K-pop life jackets, which you may remember. So we concluded that he'd fallen or jumped overboard, and the task then was to head back for where we thought this might have happened. And the time that he'd been seen walking aft was 7:30 the previous evening, when by chance I had taken a star sight and resolved it to that time. So we were placed in charge of the combined group with the other destroyers, each a mile or so on either beam, and set off back to try and achieve our 7:30 position. And I'm talking, of course, about days when there was no satellite navigation. We were outside the coverage of any radio aid, and it was simply a matter of dead reckoning, estimated position, and astronomical navigation. And we set off back for the 7:30 position, and I have to boast, too, that when the captain came on the bridge at about 6:30 the next morning, asked me when I thought we might be back at the position, I said he'll pass down our starboard side at about 8:30 tomorrow morning, and he'll be slightly closer to the USS Massey than us. And at 8:37, the Massey saw him, and he was still alive after 13 hours in water.
That's
an incredible,
incredible
story, and we have a lot more to talk about with Vice Admiral McAnally. We need to take a quick break. If you'd like to ask him a question, the toll-free line coast to coast and around the world, 1-800-878-PLAY. Once again, 1-800-878-7529. I have a bunch of questions. He's going to stay with us another segment. I'm sure Karen has a bunch of questions as well. Fascinating guests. Once again, Vice Admiral John Henry Stewart McAnally. We will take a quick break, and we will come on back right here on Sports Byline USA.
This is Karen Lyle of SailSport Talk. The annual Ida Lewis Distance Race, presented by Genoa America and scheduled for August 15th, sends sailors on an overnight coastal course that plies some of New England's most historic and scenic waters. The Ida Lewis Yacht Club, which hosts the event and sits on Lime Rock in Newport's Inner Harbor, derives its name from Miss Idawale Zureta Lewis, who in the mid-19th century famously succeeded her ill father as the Lime Rock Lighthouse Keeper. She is officially credited with saving the lives of 18 sailors over the course of her tenure, which lasted from 1860 to 1911. Visit www.ilyc.org/distance race. This is Karen Lyle of SailSport Talk, broadcasting internationally from San Francisco. SailSport Talk partnered with Sports Byline in April 2019 and has been broadcasting ever since to 168 countries around the world. Maybe you listen to us live on the Sports Byline channel of iHeart or TuneIn Radio, or on Channel 2 of CRN Talk, or on Stitcher, Twitch, or SportsByline.com. Or you may be listening on your radio to one of our 200 affiliate satellite stations across the U.S., or maybe one of the 500 satellite radio stations of the Armed Forces Network around the world. We appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening. Some of you like to tune in after the show and binge on the past episodes of SailSport Talk with Karen Lyle on iHeartRadio. It amazes me that iHeartRadio is now available across more than 250 platforms and on 2,000 devices, including smart speakers, digital audio dashes, tablets, wearables, smartphones, virtual assistants, TVs, and gaming consoles. SailSport Talk will also give you quick access to our past shows. This SailSport Talk recognition ad was brought to you by All Bay Collision. Over 60 years of experience in auto restoration and body repair for autos, buses, fleet accounts, and more. For the San Francisco Bay and Tri-City area, call 510-489-1313. All Bay Collision is a member of the ITEX Barter community, where your ITEX dollars are welcome.
Driving through the San Francisco Bay and Tri-City area, All Bay Collision is a one-stop shop including full detail wash and steam clean of engines, auto restoration, and auto body repair for cars, SUVs, buses, ambulances, box trucks, big rigs, fleet accounts, and fiberglass repair. Tow available. With over 60 years of experience, you are in good hands. Visit allbaycollision.com or call 510-489-1313 or 510-825-4727.
Thank you so much, and welcome back to Sports Byline USA across the world on American Forces Radio Network. It's our second segment, SailSportTalk.com, with our co-host Karen Lyle, and it's nice enough to join us for another segment is Vice Admiral John Henry Stuart McAnally of the Royal Navy. And Admiral, I would imagine, as my father was a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy in the 50s, he was on the Admiral's staff in the Pacific Fleet, but for you, being a guest so to speak, officer on a Navy ship, I would imagine that you had a bit of stick or banter. Did people call you Prince or Churchill? Did you get any of that?
Well, I've not been on board for very long, just after 8 o'clock in the morning. I was sitting having a cup of coffee in the wardroom, the officer's mess, which is not an unusual thing to do in the Royal Navy. I know the I soon came to realize that people start work more promptly in the United States, including the Navy. And the XO, the second in command, came up to me, and you'll excuse me if I do a terrible American accent, but I can't tell the story without trying. He said, John, he said, do you want me to treat you as a proper Royal Navy officer or like one of my own? Like one of your own, XO, I said, of course. He said, well, get up off your ass and go and do some work. I was very well treated, actually. I was the only Brit among 290 Americans at the height of the Vietnam War, which is at a time when there were 400 destroyers in the United States Navy. So you can imagine that every crew was, you know, pretty varied assortment of people. It was a fascinating experience. I had a wonderful time, and they were very good to me.
Rick, I'm going to let you ask a couple questions because I dominated last time, so you get to pursue this a little bit.
Well, you know, I was just wondering, Admiral, because I love that area of the Thames where you grew up in Richmond Park. And in fact, when I was last there in October, I took a Thames cruise down to Hampton Court Palace and to go through all the locks. It was a charming little foray on a little boat. Is that what sort of lent you to, I mean, there is such a British tradition about the Navy and going to sea, but growing up in that area, did that sort of give you that curiosity to travel on the water?
Well, it wasn't really that. I mean, it was a combination of factors, I would say. I was, you know, brought up, my boyhood was only a few years after the Second World War. It was very fresh in everyone's memory. There were lots of films, there were lots of books. Military experience in war was not at all an alien phenomenon. And my grandfather and great-grandfather had both been naval officers, and I had a couple of great-uncles who were generals, and so on. So it was, if you like, in the blood, and I would hear tales about these people. But when my father, who was a director of the John Lewis Partnership, a major retail firm, said to me shortly after I'd decided to apply for a Royal Navy scholarship and make my way into the Navy, he and my mother had separate investment portfolios. She always had first choice. And he said to me, if the Navy was a business, your mother and I would not buy shares in it. I said, well, neither would I, but it's all your fault for introducing me to Hornblower, which he had at an impressionable age. I don't know, C.S. Hornblower novels, wonderful novels about an 18th century naval officer.
Horatio Hornblower, yeah. When I was in Munich also last year, I was at the Hofbräuhaus and a great beer hall, of course, and you're sort of forced together in these big benches, and I was sitting at a bench with a bunch of Royal Navy sailors on leave, and they took me in, and within an hour we were all arm in arm singing, and I can say that a great bunch of lads, and man, could they put away the beer.
Well, indeed, of course they can. We've got approaching on Friday, actually, a little ceremony which is going to be filmed by our major television channels in alongside HMS Victory and Portsmouth Naval Base. And it's the 50th anniversary of Black top day. Does that mean anything to you?
No, it doesn't.
Why should it? Well, yeah. I'm sure you're aware that it was the custom in the Royal Navy to issue rum to the sailors at midday every day. And this practice, which began in 1655 after we'd captured Jamaica and were able to replace beer and wine with rum, continued.
Oh, you know, I remember reading about that when I was in the British Virgin Islands. And Pusser's Rum, they have a commemoration of that. And I've certainly enjoyed that lovely rum. When I've been sailing there in the BVI, which is where I would be right now if it weren't for the pandemic, actually. I have a question for you, Admiral. What is the Royal Navy Association doing these days? I think you have some events or something coming up with that, and I know that many members are listening to our show today, and we welcome them.
Well, we have about 12,000 members in the Royal Naval Association split in who belong to some over 300 branches, actually all over the world, the majority in the UK and the Republic of Ireland, but we have several in the United States as well there. And it's an organization that exists to support each other in need and to foster comradeship and generally to have fun together. The ceremony on Friday, you know, is the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the end of issuing rum, hence its name, Black Top Day.
to the end. And we have to buy it after that. Yes, everybody has to buy it.
And Pusser's Rum, which you mentioned, Karen, I'm glad you enjoy it. Pusser's Rum, it is, to me, smells and tastes exactly like what used to be issued. It's made by the same maker, the same recipe.
Admiral, you are also Commandant of the Royal College of Defense Studies, and you think about where the Navy might be at Portsmouth or in Greenwich, but this is actually a building in Belgravia, right? You're right in the heart of London there.
Yes, it was established shortly after the First World War, and because there was thought to be more of a need to bring senior officers of different services and their counterparts in other government departments, diplomats and so on, and across the then British Empire together to learn from each other and also to consider, you know, the higher aspects of grand strategy, to make, in other words, captains of war rather than just captains of ships. Winston Churchill was very much behind the inspiration of it, and it was established in a house in Westminster, but after the Second World War, moved to its present accommodation, courtesy of the Duke of Westminster, and Seaford House, Belgrave Square, and it is now very international. It always has attendees from the United States, and from usually now up to 50 other countries in any one time among its student body, which is around 100 on a year-long course, which offers the opportunity to emerge with a master's degree for those who want to take that particular aspect of it.
You've commanded many frigates.
Oh, go ahead.
The Torquay, the Alacrity, the Hermione. You've been captain of a frigate squadron. Would you say that the frigate is sort of like your ship, or is am I reading too much into it?
Well, yes, I suppose I would. It's one I've served in most, but I have also I've also commanded a mine hunter, served in two minesweepers, an aircraft carrier, a royal yacht, and a guided missile destroyer, and an American destroyer. I've been almost across the whole gamut, really.
But, I've sailed with some captains who said that they couldn't really get along with smaller boats, like sailboats and such like that, because they were so used to the big ships. Now, how is it for you? Have you ever sailed much or been on smaller boats for your own personal recreation since you've been left the service?
Well, there is a a saying, which Sir Robin would probably agree with, that there are three things that are really useless in a small boat: a cow, an umbrella, and a naval officer. But a lot of naval officers are very keen on sailing. I'm afraid I've always had a passion for golf, and there's never been time for both. But I have done quite a bit of sailing. When I was in the Australian Navy, I sailed in a Southern Cross series in a 45-footer for, over a three-month period in four or five races. And one had to qualify in two types of dinghy, and a whaler and a cutter, and a yacht when you were when I was at Dartmouth, at the Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, our equivalent of Annapolis.
Last question for you. When my dad was in the Navy in the 50s under Eisenhower, of course, in the heart of the Cold War, and they would chase after Russian subs in the Pacific, they had this sort of cat and mouse little game that they were playing. To the time, as you said, when you served, when the Vietnam War was going on, where do we stand right now with our joint naval forces, with NATO and anti-terrorism? And what do you think about Russia becoming once again maybe a specter to NATO?
Well, what you describe, activity of monitoring Russian submarines, I don't think it's too secret to tell you that nothing's really changed since the Cold War, except that it's got more active since the end of the Cold War. It went down at the end of the Cold War, but now it's back up near peak levels, really. Russian technology is much better than it was in the 70s, in part thanks to some successful espionage. And so the NATO navies are quite busy in this aspect. But I would say that I've been reading quite a lot about the Pacific War and the Second World War in the last few days, because I've been writing an article about it for the Royal Naval Association and for the Naval and Military Club, Karen, as well, too, which I know you know. And we're very pleased when we can see you back there again. And it has become apparent to me from reading this that actually the enormously close relationship that the Royal Navy and the United States Navy enjoy to this day, closer, I think, than any other two armed services in any two other countries, the foundations for that were actually laid in the British Pacific Fleet operating alongside United States Pacific Fleet and as Task Force 57 in the Third Fleet under Admiral Halsey and Admiral Spruance's command.
Well, listen, we cannot thank you enough. We're out of time. We've been speaking with Vice Admiral John Henry Stuart McAnally of the Royal Navy of the Senior Service. We really appreciate it, and let's do it again, sir.
I think we have a date for October the 7th with Sir Robin that Karen set up. But, thank you very much. I hope I didn't bore your listeners too much.
It was a pleasure having you.
Yes, it was quite the antithesis of boring. Great stuff. Karen, thank you once again, and great guest.
Yes, well, enjoyable to talk across the pond.
Good stuff. All right, I'm Rick Tittle. We'll come on back on Sports Byline.